What happens when you dig beneath the surface of a single patch of Earth? James Michener's The Source answers this question through a sweeping archaeological excavation that becomes a journey through human civilization itself. This masterpiece, published in 1965, quickly became Michener's most critically acclaimed work and remains a cultural touchstone. Oprah Winfrey named it one of her all-time favorite books, and it continues to influence how we understand the complex tapestry of Middle Eastern history. Beyond mere historical fiction, this epic narrative explores the very foundations of religious development and cultural identity, challenging readers to see how ancient patterns continue to shape our modern world. At Makor, a fictional archaeological site in Western Galilee, the past isn't simply buried, it's stacked in layers like pages of history waiting to be read. The novel opens in 1964 as archaeologist John Cullinane leads an international team excavating this ancient tell, a mound formed by successive settlements built atop one another. Each meter of soil represents centuries of human habitation, with pottery shards, coins, and building foundations serving as timestamps of civilization. What makes Michener's approach revolutionary is how he uses archaeology not merely as a backdrop, but as a narrative framework. Each layer of soil reveals not just artifacts, but complete human stories, breathing life into long-forgotten moments. As the team digs deeper, they uncover successive civilizations, modern Israeli settlements with their distinctive concrete structures, Ottoman-era buildings characterized by their distinctive archways, Crusader fortifications built to withstand siege engines, Byzantine remains adorned with intricate mosaics, Roman ruins featuring advanced water systems, and eventually prehistoric dwellings marked by crude stone tools. Each discovery becomes a portal into a fully realized historical period, complete with its own customs, conflicts, and daily rhythms. The genius of this structure is that it allows Michener to connect seemingly disparate eras through a single geographic location, demonstrating how human experiences, love, conflict, faith, and survival, echo across millennia. The archaeological framing device serves a deeper purpose. It reminds us that history isn't linear, but cumulative, a complex tapestry of overlapping influences and inheritances. Each civilization builds upon, borrows from, and sometimes deliberately erases what came before, leaving traces that only careful examination can reveal. When the team discovers an ancient water tunnel connecting the town center to its well, they're not just finding an engineering marvel, but uncovering evidence of human ingenuity, driven by the universal need for survival. This tunnel, built by a character named Hupu in the time of King David, would later be expanded by Romans, maintained by Byzantines, and eventually forgotten until modern excavation, a perfect metaphor for how civilizations are interconnected despite their apparent differences. The tunnel's construction techniques reveal technological evolution, while graffiti on its walls tell stories of the people who maintained it across centuries. The archaeological team itself represents this interconnectedness. An Irish Catholic director bringing Western archaeological methods, a Jewish kibbutznik with deep connection to the land, an Arab scholar whose family history intertwines with the site, and an American financier representing modern pragmatism. Their debates about the significance of their findings mirror the larger questions about who has the right to claim historical narratives and how the past should inform the present. Through their interactions, Michener explores how personal biases and cultural backgrounds influence historical interpretation, while their collaborative work demonstrates how different perspectives can enrich our understanding of the past. The team's diverse composition serves as a microcosm of the very layers they study, multiple viewpoints converging to create a more complete picture of human history. The most profound transformation in human history unfolds in the novel's earliest chronological chapter, set around 10,000 BCE. Here we meet Ur, an aging hunter whose wife challenges traditional cave dwelling with revolutionary agricultural ideas. This pivotal moment, the Neolithic Revolution, is portrayed not as an abstract historical concept, but through intimate family dynamics. When Ur's wife successfully grows emmer wheat and proposes building a separate house near their well, she's not just suggesting a change in living arrangements, but initiating humanity's transition from nomadic hunting to settled farming. Ur's reluctance to leave the cave, his ancestral home for 70,000 years, captures the psychological weight of abandoning traditions that had sustained humans for millennia. His sense of loss for communal living and hunting traditions reflects a universal human resistance to change, even when that change represents progress. The agricultural breakthrough is depicted with remarkable psychological insight. When Ur's son discovers that wheat can be deliberately planted rather than scattered randomly, Ur's wife immediately recognizes this will fundamentally transform their society. Men will become farmers, not hunters. This observation captures how technological innovations don't merely change how we obtain food, but reshape our entire social structure and relationship with the natural world. This shift also marks the birth of religious thought. As the family becomes dependent on rain and sun for crops, Ur's wife begins wondering how to influence these natural forces, which they perceive as spirits with wills of their own. Their son develops these ideas further when he observes a bee-eater bird destroying beneficial bees, questioning why such apparent contradictions exist in nature, and wondering if humans, too, have predators in the sky. This represents humanity's first philosophical questioning about our place in the natural order, the foundation of religious thinking. The family's gradual domestication of animals, particularly the daughter's careful befriending of a wild dog, illustrates another crucial aspect of the Neolithic Revolution. The 40-foot distance she maintains while building trust with the powerful animal symbolizes humanity's tentative relationship with nature, close enough to harness its power, but maintaining respectful boundaries. This delicate balance would define human civilization for millennia to come. Religion in the source isn't a static institution, but an evolving human response to existential questions. Meitschner traces this evolution from primitive animism through polytheism to monotheism, showing how each stage reflected changing social needs and power structures. In early Makor, we see a trinity of El, the increasingly vague father of gods, Baal, the omnipotent, and Astarte, simultaneously virgin and perpetually pregnant. This trinity explained the world's contradictions through Astarte's simultaneous love and hate for Baal, representing the eternal conflicts between female and male, night and day, winter and summer, death and life. These gods weren't abstract concepts, but immediate presences, requiring constant appeasement through rituals including human sacrifice. The arrival of Hebrew nomads led by Zadok introduces a revolutionary religious concept, an incorporeal, invisible, yet all-powerful God who speaks and appears as fire. El Shaddai exists everywhere, yet particularly with the Hebrews, a deity requiring profound faith from desert nomads who must trust in unseen waterholes and distant paths. This tension between the visible, tangible gods of settled agricultural peoples and the abstract, universal deity of nomads becomes a central conflict in the novel. When Zadok's Hebrews encounter Makor's Canaanites, their theological differences reflect deeper cultural divides. Zadok insists his people must never worship with sacred prostitutes, calling Canaanite practices abominations, while Uriel, Makor's governor, believes assimilation is inevitable. One day we shall be one people. This fundamental disagreement between exclusivity and inclusivity, between rigid boundaries and cultural exchange, would shape religious development for centuries. The evolution continues through later chapters as Judaism develops from tribal religion to sophisticated ethical system. Rabbi Asher Hagarsi's vision of a Torah scroll surrounded by a protective fence becomes a powerful metaphor for how Judaism preserved itself through strict laws that separated Jews from surrounding cultures. Yet this preservation came at a cost, creating barriers that sometimes harmed individuals like Zipporah Zetterbaum, who cannot remarry without her dead husband's brother's permission. Christianity appears in the narrative not as a rupture, but as a natural development within Judaism. When Queen Helena establishes a Christian basilica in Makor, Rabbi Asher recognizes that a new force had entered the world, and to ignore it would be folly. Later, Islam enters the picture through characters like Shalik ibn Tufik, who pragmatically converts between religions as political circumstances demand. Through these religious transformations, Meichner suggests that faith systems evolve to meet human needs while preserving core ethical insights. As Eliav reflects near the novel's end, we see God so earnestly not to find him, but to discover ourselves. Throughout the source, two architectural elements repeatedly determine a civilization's survival: access to water and defensive fortifications. These aren't merely practical concerns, but powerful symbols of how humans negotiate between openness and protection, between life-giving connection and self-preservation. The well at Makor represents continuity, the one feature that remains constant through millennia of changing civilizations. When Hupo proposes digging a massive shaft and tunnel to secure access during sieges, he's addressing the fundamental vulnerability of settled life. The 3-year project becomes a testament to human ingenuity and foresight, requiring precise engineering with weighted lines and pilot tunnels. When the tunnels finally meet, the town erupts in celebration, recognizing that this achievement ensures their survival. Walls, by contrast, represent both protection and isolation. The zigzag gate of ancient Makor forces attackers to expose their unshielded right sides, a brilliant defensive innovation. Yet walls also create separation, both physical and psychological. When Zadok's Hebrews settle outside Makor's walls, the physical barrier reinforces their cultural and religious differences from the Canaanites within. The most powerful architectural metaphor comes when Makor builds a water wall extending from the northern gate to protect the well, bringing the water source inside the town's defenses. This gives the settlement the appearance of male reproductive organs, symbolizing how water access represents fertility and life itself. Yet this protection creates vulnerability when Hebrew women must pass through town daily to access the well, creating inevitable cultural contact that tests both societies. Throughout history, Makor's defenses evolve, from simple stone walls to sophisticated Hyksos fortifications with smooth glacis stones, making it nearly unassailable. Each innovation reflects changing military technology and political realities. Yet the fundamental tension remains: how to balance protection with connection, security with exchange. This architectural symbolism reaches its culmination in modern Israel, where Eliav and Tabari debate whether walls between communities can ever truly protect without also imprisoning those they're meant to safeguard. Their discussion about Israel's security barriers reflects ancient questions about how societies balance openness with self-preservation, questions as relevant today as they were at Makor thousands of years ago. The source presents history not as a steady march of progress, but as a cyclical pattern where civilizations rise, conquer, assimilate, and eventually fall. This cycle plays out repeatedly across Makor's history, with each new wave of conquerors believing their dominance will be permanent, only to become part of the land's complex heritage. The Hebrew conquest of Makor under Zadok and his son Epher demonstrates this pattern. Despite their initial military victory and destruction of Canaanite temples, Epher later discovers his people have returned to worshiping both El Shaddai and Baal. Cultural assimilation proves more powerful than military conquest, a lesson repeated throughout the novel. This pattern reaches its most explicit expression through the character of Tabari, who explains his family's survival strategy across millennia. "My people were here before yours were formed." His ancestors had been Canaanites, Phoenicians, Jews, Greeks, Romans, Christians, Arabs, Mamluks, and Turks, adapting to each ruling power while maintaining their connection to the land itself. This perspective challenges nationalist claims to exclusive historical ownership. The Crusader period powerfully illustrates this cycle. Count Volkmar establishes Makur, as a Christian stronghold. Yet by the third generation, his descendants have adopted local customs and intermarried with the population. When Volkmar reflects on the Crusade's failure, he attributes it to insufficient European settlers, recognizing that military conquest without demographic change cannot create lasting transformation. Ottoman rule represents another turn in this cycle, with Kayyamakam Tabari embodying the empire's calculated indifference, allowing limited violence between communities while ensuring no group grows strong enough to challenge Turkish authority. This cynical system kept all communities weakened and controllable, a strategy that ultimately contributed to the empire's collapse. The modern Israeli state faces this same historical pattern, as Eliav acknowledges when debating Israel's moral claim to existence. The novel suggests that custodianship, the ability to make the land productive and protect its inhabitants, provides stronger justification than historical claims or military conquest. Yet Tabari offers a dark prophecy that this cycle will continue. Arabs will eventually unite and drive Jews into the sea, only to neglect the land until surviving Jews return to rebuild, starting the cycle anew. Amid the novel's sweeping historical scope, Michener creates a remarkable thread of continuity through the fictional family of Ur, descendants of the original prehistoric family who somehow maintain a presence at Makur across 15,000 years. This literary device allows readers to trace how individual families adapt to changing circumstances while preserving core identities. We first meet this family through Ur the Hunter, who reluctantly transitions to farming. Generations later, his descendant Ur-Baal serves as governor of Canaanite Makur, struggling between devotion to traditional gods and attraction to new religious practices. During King David's time, Jabal, nicknamed Hupo, continues the family line as an engineer who builds Makur's crucial water tunnel. In each era, family members occupy positions that allow them to both maintain traditions and adapt to changing circumstances. The family's continuity becomes increasingly improbable as conquests and migrations reshape the region's population. Yet Michener uses this device to explore how cultural DNA persists even when biological connections are broken. When Shmuel HaKohen establishes a modern Jewish settlement at Kfar Karim, he unconsciously recreates agricultural patterns established thousands of years earlier by Ur's family, suggesting that the land itself shapes human behavior across millennia. This continuity culminates in the character of Ilana HaKohen, a tough, muscular Sabra who represents the new generation of Jews in Palestine. Though she rejects rabbinical Judaism as restrictive, her connection to the land borders on religious fervor. There were Jews on this land 4,000 years ago, and I am proud to be part of that chain. When I'm gone, more Jews will live on our land for another 4,000 years. It's the land that counts. Through the family of Ur, Michener suggests that human identity persists not through racial purity or unbroken lineages, but through cultural memory and adaptation. Each generation faces unique challenges while drawing on accumulated wisdom from the past, creating a form of immortality more powerful than biological continuity. Judaism's development of comprehensive legal codes forms a central theme in the source, particularly through the chapters focusing on rabbinical debates. Michener portrays the creation of the Talmud not as dry legalism, but as a passionate effort to preserve Jewish identity through centuries of diaspora. Rabbi Asher Hagarsi's vision of a Torah scroll surrounded by a protective fence captures this concept perfectly. The fence isn't meant to imprison, but to protect, creating boundaries that would allow Judaism to survive in hostile environments. As Rabbi Naaman of Makor had instructed, build a fence around the Torah that it may be protected from thoughtless infraction. The novel shows how seemingly trivial legal discussions, whether wearing a false tooth on Shabbat constituted forbidden vanity or permissible necessity, actually represented profound philosophical inquiries. When the rabbis spend years interpreting the repeated commandment, "Thou shalt not see the kid in his mother's milk," they're not merely creating arbitrary dietary restrictions, but developing a comprehensive system that would bind Jews together throughout their coming exile. This legal development reaches its apex in the Talmudic process, where rabbis determine that 10 Jewish males over age 12 constitute a proper congregation for worship by tracing references in Numbers about the evil congregation of spies. This meticulous, sometimes convoluted process of interpretation produced an inexhaustible source of wisdom that Jews could study throughout their lives, creating intellectual continuity despite geographic dispersion. Yet Michener doesn't idealize this legal system. Through characters like Zipporah Zetterbaum, who cannot remarry without her dead husband's brother's permission, he shows how rigid application of ancient laws sometimes harms individuals. The tension between law as protection and law as prison becomes a central question in modern Israel, where Eliav must decide whether to modernize religious restrictions or preserve traditions that have sustained Jewish identity through centuries of persecution. The novel suggests that law functions best when it balances preservation with adaptation. As Rabbi Asher teaches, Torah exists in the hearts of men and must be interpreted with both rigor and humanity. This balance between tradition and innovation, between community standards and individual needs, remains a fundamental challenge for all legal systems, religious and secular alike. The novel culminates in modern Israel's struggle to reconcile ancient religious identity with contemporary secular statehood, a tension embodied in the character of Ilan Eliav. Once a German Jew named Isidor Gatzman, he transforms after his wife Ilana's death into a fierce defender of Israel, eventually taking a cabinet position in the Israeli government. Eliav faces impossible choices that symbolize Israel's broader dilemmas. As a Kohen, priest, he cannot marry his beloved Vered Bar-El, a divorcee, despite her later widowhood. This personal restriction mirrors the nation's struggle between religious tradition and modern life. Similarly, his inability to help Zipporah Zetterbaum remarry represents the conflict between ancient laws and contemporary needs. The debate between Eliav and American financier Paul Zodman captures competing visions of Jewish identity. Eliav insists Israel needs immigration, not just financial support, while Zodman defends America as the best home Jews have ever had, comparing Israel to the Vatican, a spiritual center for Judaism that most Jews shouldn't need to live in. This argument reflects real tensions between Israeli and diaspora Jewish communities that continue today. Vered's decision to leave Israel with Zodman articulates a powerful critique of the burden of constant historical consciousness. She explains she's exhausted by the burdens of a religion becoming a state. "I've done my part for Judaism," she declares, tired of constantly remembering the Jewish past. She longs for the simpler Jewish life she witnessed among American Jewish women who contributed to their communities without the weight of constant historical remembrance. The novel's most striking modern character may be the Vodger Rebbe, who represents ultra-Orthodox rejection of secular Jewish statehood. His insistence that Israel has no right to exist except as a religious state directly contradicts the pragmatic secularism of characters like Ilana HaKohen. Yet when the Rebbe leads ecstatic dancing until dawn, taking Eliav by the hand to join, he demonstrates that religious tradition contains joyful vitality alongside rigid restrictions. Eliav's final pilgrimage up the English stairs in Safat, where each step evokes memories of Israel's independence war, suggests that modern Jewish identity must incorporate both religious tradition and national struggle. His conclusion that life isn't meant to be easy, it's meant to be life, reflects Michener's view that identity requires constant negotiation between past and present, between tradition and innovation. Throughout The Source, the land itself emerges as the most enduring character, outlasting civilizations, absorbing their contributions, and shaping human destiny across millennia. From prehistoric hunters who first discovered the well to modern archaeologists excavating its layers, the land remains the constant presence that connects all human stories. This connection is physical as well as spiritual. When Hupu's wife Kareth longs desperately for Jerusalem, seeing it as the spiritual center where Yahweh will make himself known, she expresses the Jewish mystical connection to specific geography. Similarly, when Alana weeps at seeing malaria-ridden swamps that were once fertile fields, declaring Jews must reclaim the land because God intended it, she identifies God with the land itself. The novel's archaeological framework reinforces this theme by showing how the land preserves human history in its physical layers. When Tabari discovers a hand axe dating back some 200,000 years among charred stones from one of the world's first intentional fires, he's connecting with humanity's earliest presence at this site. The petrified elephant's molar found nearby provides evidence of great beasts once slaughtered at this ancient waterhole, reminding us that the land's memory extends beyond human history. Michener presents the relationship between people and land as reciprocal. Humans shape the land through agriculture, architecture, and warfare, while the land shapes human societies through its resources, climate, and geography. This reciprocity creates a moral dimension to land ownership. Cullinane concludes that Israel's strongest claim stems from custodianship, the ability to restore productivity to land that had deteriorated under previous rulers. Yet the novel acknowledges competing claims to the same territory. When Tabari explains why he didn't flee in 1948, "I belong to this land, this well, these olive trees. My people were here before yours were formed." He articulates a connection as profound as any Jewish claim. The final conversation between Eliav and Tabari suggests that true peace might come not from exclusive possession, but from shared recognition of the land's power to connect all who have loved it. In the novel's closing image, Eliav looks down on Galilee from the heights of Zaphat, contemplating the tension between rigid tradition and living faith. The land spreads before him as it has for thousands of years, a physical reminder that human conflicts are temporary while the earth endures. This perspective doesn't resolve the region's conflicts, but places them within a larger context where mutual recognition of the land's significance might eventually lead to reconciliation.